I'm afraid I will be speaking in English because linguistic imperialism, at least, is not dead. Yes, I'm going to be talking about a particular instance in the archaeological history of historic Palestine. It takes place, or it's a couple of events related to one another, which take place in 1899, 1900, and 1901 in a region that, roughly speaking, we can call Beit Jibrin. So, this map is not actually of a territorial unit that made sense in Ottoman Palestine, because it was divided up, the area that we call known as Palestine, in the Mandate era, which does conform to these borders, was actually divided between a number of different Ottoman units of administration, which kind of roughly cut here and here. But here's Jerusalem, and Beit Jibrin is here. So this is what is now the Gaza Strip. So we're talking about somewhere slightly to the northeast of this. One of the other parts of this Beit Jibrin area of historical archaeological significance is known as Maresha or Merissa. This is a much more close-up map of the area that's actually from one of the archaeological reports. So Beit Jibrin here is one of the main towns in the area. We've got Jerusalem and Bethlehem up here amongst sort of better known places, Mediterranean coast along here. So in terms of the areas actually being dug during this expedition, we have Tel Sembahana, Tel El Judeda, Tel Zakaria, and Tel Safi. Beit Jibrin is the main village in this particular area. Tel, in this context, refers to a hill that is not kind of naturally occurring in a geological sense, but which has built up through layers of occupation deposits. So tells are a feature of a lot of the Middle Eastern landscape, and they are largely composed. The reason they particularly occur in this part of the world, and this is going through to Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, is because of the use of mud brick as a building material. And so it forms, as each layer of occupation kind of disintegrates, it forms another band, and you end up with these, to some extent, quite distinctive hill shapes. You can generally tell from a that was entirely unintentional from a natural hill, but some of them may well be kind of 10,000 years old, because if we're thinking of somewhere like Jericho, we are talking about places that have been occupied for a very, very long period of time. So that's the actual place that I'm talking about. In terms of the kind of background in an academic sense to how archaeology in the Middle East, and particularly in Palestine, is thought of at this point in time, and particularly in relation to colonialism, there's a reasonable amount of mentions and material on the idea that archaeology is, particularly in the Palestinian context, but also in slightly different ways in places like Lebanon and Iraq and Egypt, part of a kind of appropriation on a grand scale. So on one level, it's about appropriation of objects. This, of course, is the period in which, you know, the British have taken the Elgin marbles at the beginning of the century. The Louvre is being filled with objects from the Middle East. In Germany, there's the amazing frieze from Qasr al-Mushatta, just outside current-day Amman, goes to the Pergamon. This is a period at which enormous amounts of fantastic objects are being taken, not just in order to beautify and to educate Western publics, but in order to kind of create a detachment of knowledge and of objects and of the history itself from the current populations
of these places. So a lot of this, a lot of the narrative around this is about the idea that Greek history, Roman history, but also Pharaonic history, or the history or the archaeology of the Babylonians and the Assyrians are not the property of the places in which those remains are, they are world heritage. And of course, this is very much a discourse that is very much alive today and very difficult and troubling today with regards to the Middle East, because obviously we have these situations of whether, you know, debates over whether remains are safer in a place run by ISIS than they are in a colonial museum, and it's a very, very difficult kind of set of debates that are going on. But this is something, a set of discourses that very much finds its origins in the late 18th and 19th centuries, and which build up and up during the 19th century. And it's accompanied in terms of the way in which archaeologists and anthropologists talk about the people who live in Middle Eastern countries as firstly uninterested in history and archaeology, so just portraying them as just not simply not interested in these objects or in these remains. Secondly, as actively dangerous to them, as using these remains for building materials or looting them to sell and all of these kind of things. And also, once we feed into this, the narratives of race that are current at the time, in finding ways of arguing that the people who are living in these places at this period in time are not biologically the descendants of the people who created these remains and therefore don't have a right to them, and therefore that Western culture, which sees itself as the descendant of particularly these classical remains, but also to some extent of other civilizations, does have a greater right to them. What we don't really have much of in terms of thinking about what goes on in this kind of archaeological, and it's very much a developing field at this point of time, especially in the very, very late 19th and early 20th centuries, in terms of method and how digging actually happens. What we have very, very little of is thinking about the actual places that these digs happen and about the people doing most of the physical work. The standard picture of archaeology is, of course, sort of Indiana Jones. It's a lone white male who is expert, who directs everything that goes on, who makes the discoveries. All of the reports of archaeological excavations are phrased in terms of one or two white Western males who do the discovering and do all of the interpretation. There are a couple of exceptions to that. Zeynep Cehan has done some interesting work on kind of the Ottoman Empire generally and archaeology within it, and she looks particularly at the workforces in a few sites in Iraq. And Stephen Quirk has looked at Petrie's workforces in Egypt to try and tease out some of the ways that these colonial relationships happen kind of on the ground and in terms of the actual sites, rather than looking solely at the kind of imperial meta level. So what I want to do with this particular case study is to draw some of these strands together and to do two main things. One of those is to think about what archaeological labour on these sites means for social disruption to the places where digs occur, and to think about the role that archaeology plays, not in this kind of general sense of imperialism and kind of colonial appropriation of territory in which it's been written about, but in a very specific and literal kind of way in on particular pieces of ground. So in terms of Beit Jibrin, the reason that I picked this particular case study is because it throws up both of these types of example. It's got the issue of kind of labour and what goes on at the kind of village level in relation to this, and also in terms of what goes on in terms of land It also is quite a specific and well-documented instance of imperial intervention in this sense, which is something a bit rare in these fields. There's a lot of the primary sources on which I draw are very kind of scattered in terms of what you can find in these things. It's very much a matter of reading between lines and against the grain. Beit Jibrin itself. The archaeological remains at Beit Jibrin shows that this goes back into certainly the classical period in terms of there being forms of settlement there, and probably earlier. There are substantial remains from the Hellenistic period in Palestine, including a lot of what we see here, which are these very unusual underground chapels, dwellings, all sorts of things. There's quite a specific geology in this area. So right up to probably the early 20th century, there have been underground dwellings in this part of Palestine. There may possibly still be people, they're certainly used still, there may still be some people kind of pretty much living in them, but not in this particular set. So there is a long tradition of different forms of settlement here. It comes right through the Christian period, the early Islamic period, the Crusade period, and then into the various later periods of Islamic rule. Within the kind of the last couple of hundred years, during the Mandate period, there is a certain amount of Zionist settlements that are established in this region. And in the War of 1948, it ends up right on the border between the newly established State of Israel and the Jordanian-controlled West Bank. So it ends up in quite a lot of international newspaper reports because of cross-border raids from both sides. 1967, when Israel also occupies the West Bank, it then ends up again as this sort of slightly liminal space. It's now an Israeli National Park area. So what you see are buildings like this, which are the sort of Ottoman-era Palestinian ones, Arab ones, most of which have now been either kind of left to stand as part of a depopulated landscape or are actually used for things like visitor centres. The inhabitants of the villages from 1948 largely are now refugees in the West Bank, so that nowadays, if you Google the words Beit Jibrin, a lot of what comes up is actually a refugee camp in Bethlehem that is now known by that name because that's where most of the inhabitants are from. So the name is almost kind of transferred itself, certainly in the Arabic form, into the West Bank, whereas it's now in Hebrew, Beth Kuvrin, or Mauritia, which is one of the well-known sites. So in terms of the excavations that happen, these are examples of what the labourers look like on these sort of excavations. They are mainly coming from local villages. One of the things that always pops up at the beginning of reporting of an excavation is accounts of the negotiations that have gone on between the Western dig directors and local villagers over the terms and conditions of their employment. The kind of employment we're talking about is bulk. By this period in time, large-scale excavation of this kind in the Holy Land basically kicks off with Flinders Petrie in the 1880s. By this time, a decent-sized excavation might employ well over 100 people. And if you consider that not only the British, but also the Americans, the Germans, the French, sometimes the Italians, are digging across the country, you're looking at what starts to be, in terms of the sort of industries that actually exist in this period, in this region, a fairly sizable employer, because on top of those, you're also potentially employing specialists like carpenters, because a lot of these excavations involve tunneling. And also, one of the things that doesn't necessarily get represented in these photos, although I suspect this guy might actually be one, is you get educated, often Christian, sometimes Lebanese and sometimes Egyptian, but rarely Palestinian locally, men who act as overseers or foremen on the sites. So there is also a kind of what we might sort of call a rudimentary class thing going on here. So 1899 and 1900, we have a series of excavations on some of those different tells in the area that I mentioned, funded by the Palestine Exploration Fund, which still exists in London, and led by two British directors. They change over in the middle. One is a guy called Frederick Jones Bliss, who is an American raised in Lebanon. His father is one of the founders of the what is then the Syrian Protestant College, now the American University in Beirut. The other is a guy called R.A.S. McAllister, Robert McAllister, a Scot who ends up as the Professor of Celtic Studies at University College Dublin. Bliss, and as individuals, the two of them actually make quite an interesting contrast in terms of the materials they produce. Bliss is fluent in Arabic, and he's grown up in Lebanon. I think he was actually born there. And although he writes in the sort of fairly standard paternalistic, patronizing, colonial terms, he is genuinely interested and quite respectful of a lot of local people in terms of the idea that they have agency, they have humanity, they are human beings in their own right with valid positionalities. McAllister, and I got into an argument with a Palestinian academic over this when I presented at Birzeit, is basically, and excuse my language, a bastard. But he's horrible to everybody, he hates everyone, and he's suspicious of everyone. He lightens up a little bit in when he gets older, but at this point in time, he is just a deeply unpleasant human being who is horrible about anybody he mentions and seems to trust absolutely nobody. So these are the two people that we're mainly relying on for reports of the actual excavations. So this is Bliss, and one of the interesting things about this dig is that he starts off by reporting the terms of the firman, the Turkish, the Ottoman document that he has to get in order to actually do the digging. So, according to the terms of the permit, all objects discovered, including duplicates, were to be the property of the Imperial Museum. That's in Istanbul, although there's a small one being established at this point of time in Jerusalem. The excavators having the right only to drawings, photographs, and casts. Not only was a commissioner of the museum attached to the camp to see that the law was enforced, but before the delivery of the permit, I was obliged to sign a declaration stating that I would observe all the laws on excavation. The direction of the campaign was in my hands. And there's almost a resentful tone in this, I think, to the idea that he has to hand everything over to the Ottomans. And this is a fairly new development. It's part of legislation that is passed in the 1880s. So he's actually had 10 years of working in these rules, but he seems to still be quite annoyed by it, even though he does have a sort of vaguely enlightened attitude in comparison with a lot of archaeologists. But it's kind of, it sort of speaks to the fact that there had been this assumption amongst the European and American archaeological communities that what you find you could generally, either legally or illegally, take back to your museum in London or Philadelphia or Paris or whatever other country it was that you were collecting for. Things have slightly changed here, and the Ottomans, and this is very much part of a discourse of modernization, modernity that's going on in the Ottoman Empire at this point in time, in which the Ottomans are starting to lay claim to these classical remains that Europe had been claiming as part of their sort of cultural patrimony. But of course, Palestine isn't Istanbul. So one of the things this dig very much indicates, and it happens even more later on, as I'll discuss, is that there is a double layering of imperialism going on here. There is direct Ottoman control, and there is indirect European and American imperialism enforcing itself in this particular situation. In terms of relationships with the people on the ground, amongst whom Bliss and McAllister are having to buy supplies, from whom they are recruiting their workforce, and whose land and crops they are interfering with, there is, as I said, this process of negotiation which has to go on. So, again, this is Bliss. The question of wages was not so easily settled. As Zachariah is in the heart of a charcoal country, we had to compete with that trade, which furnishes work all the year round. Again, our arrival was synchronous with the olive gathering, which made the people more independent. The wages finally agreed upon ranged according to the age, sex, and capacity of the labourer, averaging about a franc a day. This rate never varied during our 2 years' work, but we secured all the competent men we wished during harvest time. At Tel El Hesi, a different site where he started off digging in Palestine about 10 years earlier, the rates were lower, but all our workpeople deserted us during the harvest, and we were obliged to raise the men's wages during the ploughing season. So this quotation speaks to a couple of different themes. One is the fact that in most of the archaeological literature, the workforces are either completely voiceless, almost entirely nameless, and they exist solely either occasionally finding something or more often as some kind of inconvenience, because as is suggested here, they disappear because the harvest is on, or the other reason is because it's Ramadan and they won't dig during the hot days while they're fasting. But what it does kind of highlight is that there is variation amongst these workforces, who are often portrayed in the literature as this sort of uniform, nameless mass. They have quite a significant level of agency in terms of their bargaining power, because there is pretty much no way that these digs can actually bring people from any great distance. They need large numbers living locally, and certainly at the PEF, they don't have the funds to build local workers' villages, which is what the German and American expeditions in Iraq tend to do, because they're really well bankrolled. There is also this issue of the fact that because of both general harvest demands, and also because there is already industry going on in this area. And again, this is something that's often not reflected in a lot of the historiography on Palestine. Palestine at this point in time is generally talked about as if it's a kind of uniform subsistence economy. It's not. Palestine has been integrated into European trade relations for a long time at this point, in terms of things like cash crop cotton. This is a more local trade, this production of charcoal for urban markets. But again, there are different competing things going on here. There is also something that is surprising to a lot of people when we look at archaeological workforces at this period in time, and that's the fact that there's a lot of women working on these digs. Now, to some extent, that's because they are cheap labour, because the men who do the mattocking, the actual breaking up of the earth, get paid a bit more. Women and boys tend to be paid slightly less, and they're carrying baskets to move the earth away. But certainly the reports from both this site and from others are that women women very much want this paid labor, and it's not the only paid labor they're doing. There are also reports, because they are basically rivals for one another's workforces, of them doing work for European and Zionist settlers in the area, doing things like distilling herbs and gathering herbs. What this particular quotation also highlights is Yusuf. And Yusuf is Yusuf Kanaan. He is one of these Lebanese Christian foremen that I mentioned. I promised in the title of this class, and then I sort of took it back out again because there was too much to talk about. I can bring it in during questions if people want. So that's the main dynamics at this set of sites. There is also this issue of Ottoman imperial authority and the fact that we have, along with the European leaders of the digs, an Ottoman official from Jerusalem who comes and lives on the dig, and he is there to keep an eye on the Europeans, which kind of illustrates the sort of tensions you have between Ottoman power and these kind of, this informal level of imperialism, of European infiltration into the Ottoman Empire that's going on at this point in time, but it also has effects in the local area. And that's something that gets exacerbated later on. Because just after this dig closes, this is discovered. And this is an underground chapel, possibly, painted. The upper image is taken in 1901 by a Palestinian, or a Jerusalemite, actually of Lebanese origin, photographer called Khalil Raad. And he creates enormous amounts of magnesium dust in all of these tombs in order to take these photos. This is actually a lithograph taken from one of his images. This is a modern photo of the same place, so you can see that they've effectively remained the same. Now, when this underground tomb is discovered, the reaction of the PEF's agents, the Palestine Exploration Fund's agents in Jerusalem, is firstly to come and record it. Secondly, it is to get in a massive panic about how the locals are going to destroy it. There have already been some acts of kind of iconoclasm by a local imam, allegedly, at one of these sites because there were human images. And he, according to their narrative, which is full of all sorts of kind of Islamophobic ideas about words like fanatic, and they're worried that the same kind of treatment will be meted out on this site. So they get the director of the Imperial Museum in Istanbul and the local minister of public instruction in Jerusalem to close the tomb. And they do that by direct lobbying and also by going through their individual consulates. Even though they're employed by the British, we're now talking about a German and an American. And so these tombs in this area of Beit Jibrin, which has a large amount of archaeological remains spread throughout the landscape, are closed off. They're locked up, there's special doors put on them. And if you want to go in, you now have to apply to an official in Hebron, which it's the nearest city, but it's not actually that close. So we're kind of looking again at this sort of double imperial structure of imposing a new land ownership or land control regime that happens in this particular instance, but this isn't necessarily an isolated incident, on the logic that local people in this place are not interested in, despite something that Bliss says in one of the quotes earlier, they're not interested in, they're not related to, they're not responsible for these things in their area. They're only an alien damage to them. And therefore, they have to be cut off from them by external powers. So, to conclude, as I said, there is already a sort of a developing, although still quite small, literature on the idea that archaeology in the Middle East is this process, is involved in this process of large-scale imperial processes. On the kind of intellectual and cultural levels, particularly in the West, in the development of museums as part of national projects. What I also want to kind of stress through these sort of micro histories is that we're also looking at something that kind of involves imperial impositions on the small scale, on the local scale, but that is part of a quite literal appropriation of land and territory in these Middle Eastern archaeological settings. Thank you very much.